Hello, and welcome to issue 9 of the British Tech Network's Comics Podcast. Once again, we've all gathered together around the microphone to discuss comics and, well, anything else that comes to mind, really. We promise this week we're going to be under the hour and a half, unless it gets really interesting, in which case we're going to be so over the hour and a half that you're going to be here next week listening to what we have to say. And I've got gathered with me the usual suspects, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I'm on a diet, so I'm going to be famine. I'm going to introduce you from it's gone, isn't it? It's Denver, isn't it, Jeff?
Yes, that
Jeff,
totally
Denver,
works.
Colorado. We have Jeff Gowett, who is masquerading as...
Pick a horseman for me. Who seems appropriate?
Plague.
Plague. Hi, I'm Jeff, and I'm Plague.
Yes.
Still, I'm staying on the other side of the pond. We've got from Portland in Oregon, we've got Miss Kelly Gamont, and she will be reprising her famous role as...
Pestilence.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
I think.
Maybe.
And back over in the UK, in London, in sunny, sweltering London, we have Paul Kirkle, who is My Little Pony.
Also known as War. Thank you very much. Thanks, Andy.
Together we are Armageddon.
Hooray!
Yay! Podcast, yay! Everyone. So, we've actually got a theme to discuss this week in some bizarre way. We've meandered on for 8 episodes about random comic strip adventures. And we've decided to focus in this week on comic strips, a.k.a. the funnies, as people call them. Although, obviously, not all of them are funny. Some of them are hilarious, and some of them are just downright odd. So we're going to be discussing that. We've got the news. We've got Better Than Wavy Gravy, as ever, despite continual pressure not to be naming and shaming. We will continue to name and shame. And there we go. So, but before we get cracking, Jeff, in your inimitable Colorado accent, we've had another review.
Yes, we have. Okay, this comes from Dominic O'Rourke. Excellent podcast with a fine pedigree. Springing from the tech podcasts of the British Tech Network, this podcast mixes just the right formula for me of technical and comics. Holy crap. I'm totally improving this. So sorry, Dominic. I'm going to try again. Excellent podcast with a fine pedigree. Springing from the tech podcasts of the British Tech Network, this podcast mixes just the right formula for me of technology and comics. The hosts mix an excellent knowledge of fandom and technical understanding of the industry. Some great squee moments, which clearly is directed at Kelly. I added that part. That was a parenthetical addition for me. Getting carried away by the things they love. Dominic gave us only 3 stars, which tells me that pretty high standards there. So considering who we are, the fact that we got 3 stars is probably fantastic.
I think so.
Yeah, he sounds from what he says, he's obviously not a guy that gives 4 or even 5 stars away at the drop of a hat.
Oh, I blame Skype. We'd have had 5 if it weren't for Skype.
Oh, Skype is such a bitch.
So we do know then, officially, as a matter of record, we know that 4 people listen to this podcast now.
This is very true.
That's 1 listener each.
That's right. We get 1 more listener and we're outnumbered.
My listener lives in the garage and I'm not letting him out until he sends me a proper review.
And when you say lives...
It's not a good life, obviously.
But it's a life nonetheless.
It is, if you can call it living.
It's all a matter of perspective. The exactly. Creepy part is when they're whimpering and they keep saying, "Stop hugging me! Stop hugging me!"
I mean, he just looks at me. He just goes, "Tell me what you want."
You know what? This is an excellent way to start the funnies.
It is, isn't it? Well, I'm sure somebody somewhere this morning told me that I was given some firm instructions about drifting. No, it's gone. It's gone. It's gone.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, there's some news, which I believe you've been adding in, Kelly. Have you not? Because I certainly didn't add it in.
I have been. I found an article that actually, and this was hard to find, about news out of Comic-Con, which, imagine my surprise. So it was comic book news out of Comic-Con, not TV stuff, not movie stuff. Comic book news. And so there were three highlights, I thought, in what I found that were covered. First is that Chuck Palahniuk is going to be writing a sequel to Fight Club, and it is going to be a graphic novel. That's what makes it comic news, which is going to be pretty interesting, I think. I want to know how they're going to swing that. Little Nemo, for those who remember the strip, Little Nemo is back. They're redoing the story, which sort of a reboot in a different direction. They're not trying to remake the one that they had. They're trying to go in a new way with that. And that the cover looks amazing. I really, really liked it. And then Paul and I now get to completely freak out because we had a whole thing about the Max a few issues back. And now that the Max is 20 years old, my lawn, you're on it. I would really they're gonna remaster it, and so there's gonna be like some additional coloring and I think some additional stuff from Sam Keith in some new editions of the Max, and I've been going back through and reading some of the older ones, and I'm really excited to see where that goes. I think it's gonna be really awesome. And when I first saw that, I thought, my first thought was, I wonder if Paul has heard yet. And then my second thought was, I can't wait to see what it looks like, because particularly getting, this is another one of those things about the internet where I got to find out I wasn't the only person who ever read that comic book and enjoyed it. And so I was really excited to get to also share that with someone else and get the chance to have the squee moment over getting not necessarily new Max material, but having it treated really well and then released. And I'm really looking forward to it.
No, I can't wait. And I'll tell you what, I didn't know that news, and I was umming and ahhing the other day about rebuying the Max, because I've got the last collected edition, but everything else in monthly comics. But at the time, my comic shop, well, the comic shop that was most local to me, shut down, so I couldn't get the comics in any sort of order. So I bought the last one as a collected trade, and I was just umming and ahhing, do I get the rest as trades, just so I can read the lot through from beginning to end. But if they're re-releasing it, sold, sign me up. I am so there.
There you go.
Does that earn a double squee just for Dominic?
A huge squee. Big squee.
Absolutely.
Oh, you meant from Kelly.
But so yay. I'm super excited about it. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing how they re-release it, how it gets jazzed up and remastered.
The whole remastering thing is in some ways it's great, and other ways it's a can of worms, isn't it? Because quite often they'll take a strip and new editors, new people in charge, and they'll rescan the artwork, you know, recolorize it, bump everything up, and you know, there's a temptation to kind of max everything out, and when in comic strips that rely on you know, sort of 15, 20-year-old comic strips that relied on being a little grungy, and the original strip was a little dark because comics were printed different in those days, and everything gets re-bumped up. You know, and I'm not a big fan of that. For me, remastering is like, you know, just trying to keep it as bang on as it was.
I totally agree with you, Andy, but I do hope they max it up for this one.
Well, it says that they are. What it says in the article is, as for remastered, this just means going back to the original art and scanning it in a higher resolution, catching a lot of line work and brushwork that didn't show up in the single issues. A lot of detail gets lost in the shrunken down painted panels I did. Luckily, we were able to get almost every single Max original page rescanned.
Oh, that's cool. That does sound like more sort of like conservation than just...
Yeah.
That's a lot of work, scanning all those graphics.
Was it 2000 AD? They were saying they re-released... I think it was Slane And they said that they had to re-scan the printed comic books.
Oh, yeah,
they didn't have all the artwork.
But they're so careless. They've lost so much stuff.
And they lost so much of the detail in the artwork.
I know.
Because they were scanning a reprint on really bad paper.
I know, and it's already printed at 150 DPI.
And you just think the artwork
with
is so
gorgeous.
With an
85-line screen.
Yeah. I mean, it looked good enough when you were reading it as a comic, but it's really, if you're going to reprint it at properly these days, it doesn't hold together. But yeah, if you've got access to the original art, then bonza.
Yeah. Yep.
So what is it with the UK just tossing out incredible works of art?
Yeah, if it's not culturally significant, we just don't care.
God.
Now, ownership, that was a different matter. But having, keeping it. I mean, I think we've lost so much good stuff from...
But also, it's down to who used to own the stuff, isn't it? Because back in the days of IPC, it was their copyright. So the artist would draw the strip, send it into IPC. They'd never see their own strip again.
Never see it again.
No. Yep. And IPC, monolithic, multinational corporation, print the stuff, as far as they're concerned, chuck it in the bin.
That was a piece of the Max remaster, is that... the title itself bounced through a couple of different publishers, and now Sam Keith has the rights back. And so that's part of why they're getting remastered. And he's also adding some additional scenes, things that were cut from the original titles that were going to be included in the collections, but never quite made the cut. So,
I'd like to see is stuff like that. If it's reissued, obviously it's a print comic, but it also comes out, I would guess, in some form is digital content. When you buy a digital album, you get your iTunes extras and things like that. It would be just awesome to have in the package of the comic, the pencils, the concept art, the layout sketches for particular pages, that sort of thing. Everyone's completely used to the idea of the video commentary on DVD, but that would be so brilliant just to have extra layers of content on a digital comic about how it was created, how it was drawn. Yeah, I would pay extra for
and
that.
And sometimes you get that in a paper version. I've been checking out a bunch of titles. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I just like the writers and artists' commentary. I'd love to see. My favorite. I've got when I came into comics, it was just for the artwork, and writing was not something I ever took an interest in. Now I do, and there are some writers, and this is where the Max comes into me, because it is such a beautifully personally. Fabulously written project by Sam Keith, that even though he's a gorgeous artist, the writing is stunningly good. But I've never heard him speak. I'd love to hear him just talk about various panels and various pages and parts of the story arc and characters, and to hear who his favourite character is and his favourite scene, and just having these little speech bullets, in Comixology or any digital app, you load up a comic and then you get these occasional little tiny post-it note speech bubbles, and if you click on it you get a minute of the guy talking about it.
Awesome.
I'd love something like that.
Yes, definitely, because you get a real feeling for the backwards and forwards. I mean, I know that from the stuff that I've been chucking up on the community with the comic and thing, the strip that I've been doing, the sort of the back and forth, they're like, yes, no, they're not right, okay, yes, this is fine, no, I've changed my mind, no, this needs to be like this, why, and that, this iteration, and then and you end up, I mean, people assume that a comic artist is just someone, they just open their computer or get their sort of, brush out and bosh, off it goes. But it so patently is not that. There is such a level of thought and things behind the best art that is, I think people could well do with being exposed to that.
Yeah.
Well, it's my favorite bit of the comments I've been reading lately, because I've been picking up some titles that you guys have recommended and things, and a lot of issue ones and sometimes issue twos don't have a letter section yet. And so they will put in, like, here's a page of concept art, since we don't have a letters page yet because nobody's read it, so they can't write in and tell us how great we are. So here's, some rough sketches of this guy, and here's like what the original panel looked like before we colored it or whatever. And I'm always disappointed once they start getting letters, because I love that section before
I am too.
I'll tell you, it's just popped. God, why does this stuff pop out of your head? I remember, Paul, you probably don't remember this. This is going to go willfully obscure, but issue one of 2000 AD had a letters page. And,
did it?
Yeah, it did. Okay. And weirdly, and in it there was a thing about, you know, send us your thing, and there was a, they used to do a thing in 2000 AD that you could send your drawings in and you'd win some money.
Yep, yeah, I remember that.
Anyway, so they had in issue one, don't ask me how they had it, but they had an illustration, you know, Tharg's star illustration of the week, and it was an illustration of some futuristic tank and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, it said that this picture had ostensibly been sent in to issue one of this comic by an Earthlit who went by the name of Kevin O'Neill.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Now, the art director of 2000 AD for issue one was Kevin O'Neill. And looking back at this picture, it bears a startling resemblance to Kevin O'Neill's own artwork. I'm guessing they had to pay him the £5.
Fair enough. And actually, probably that might have been the going rate for a page at that point. Who knows? Actually, it reminded me of something. One of my favourite 2000 AD strips, partially because I know John Walker and Pat Mills said they didn't like it, but was a Judge Dredd one called City of the Damned.
Oh, yeah.
Where they go forward in the future and they find out the entire city has been wiped out by a mutant, and lovely, cheerful, happy, funny story fitting in with today. But Steve Dillon was doing the artwork for it, and he was posting the artwork from his studio to 2000 AD, and they lost an entire issue's worth in the post, and it was just lost in the post. Oh. So he had to redo an entire set of pages within a couple of days in order to get it into the comic on time. And later on they found it, and they showed the two sets of pages back to back next to each other as a comparison thing. That's interesting. It's the stuff like that. I want to hear more about that. I want to know more about that. I want to hear Neil Gaiman talk about the typewriter ribbon that snapped halfway through writing Violent Cases. I want to hear Dave McKean talking about Mr. Punch and what his favourite picture is of the whole lot. This is the stuff. I love comics, but I love it when people talk about the making of comics in the way that I love director commentary in films.
We totally need a commentary track.
Yes.
Oh, that would be so awesome.
Anyway, so moving on, as I've been instructed to do,
Yes, sir.
Fall in line, troops.
In every 5 minutes saying, stay on target.
Fall in line, troops.
Now, I'm picturing that there's someone on the other side of your desk right now, someone in specific, with a watch on their wrist, and they're looking at you, you know, like over the top of their glasses, and they're just tapping on the watch face on their wrist. I say that with love, of course.
I've just got a mental image of somebody going, DHM, you've turned off your targeting sensor. Is there a problem?
No, we've got this podcast under control.
Oh, no, not to drift further, but did you? I found this set of things on the internet comparing Star Wars with
Star Wars and Game of Thrones.
I'm hungry.
Yes. Princess Leia, I kissed my brother once.
That's
the
cute.
Queen. That's cute.
Old Chewbacca, roar!
Yes.
Hodor.
Hodor. It's a subreddit, you guys, and it's totally worth checking out. Yeah. It was probably me because I went, "Oh my god, this is awesome!" They were pretty entertaining. There were some that were very, very clever.
Yes, my sword's on fire. That's cute.
That's cute. Like, they were really good. Oh.
Anyway, so section two, on with Better Than Dave Gibbons. You notice how we can now, that we're on issue nine, we can seek effortlessly from one subject to another, in much in the way that Carl did in the Mac show.
Mm. Better than that.
That was pretty acrobatic of him, I have
it
to
was,
say.
It was, wasn't it? He was, yeah, mental acrobatics of the highest order there.
Very smooth.
I've just gone for the, get on with it.
Stop! Done.
Well, to be fair, when you're working with us, it is much like herding cats.
It is like herding cats. I've heard that said. Yes.
ADD cats.
Yeah.
Full of coffee.
Or wine.
No, coffee. Wine would just make them more laid back.
Oh, look at Paul. You've added it in. Okay, so this week we've got a collection of four artists that are designed to let everyone know that there are people out there that can draw in a spectacular fashion. That may or may not be better than other artists that have made a not inconsiderable living from the comic strip form in their time.
And who may or may not have lawyers bigger than all four of us combined.
Yes. Yes, so we're not even going to anagramize their name
yes,
anymore.
Yes, but you know we'll make fun of them when they draw up the contracts. Oh, we know people that could draw those better than you.
You see, like, clause 8, you've repeated clause 8 9 times on one page. Is there something significant about clause 8?
No, it's to build suspense. God,
not
people.
You've changed the last word. Emotion lines.
Paul.
Yes,
rescue
hello.
Us from lawyer hell.
Tell us you're better then.
Herg. I like Herg, who did the Tintin adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Love Tintin. Actually, as a kid, I didn't get Tintin at all. Because I think it did just require too much, not literacy, but there was too much reading within it. There was too much visual reading. It's much more of a novel meets a graphic novel to me. Whereas Asterix was much more immediate and
funny.
Oh, you
do that too.
Yeah, no, I always do it. I love Asterix, and I think Asterix is fabulous and wonderful, but Asterix, you can read in 5-10 minutes, an entire comic book, graphic novel of it. And it's great, but it's very light and not inconsequential, but very light. Whereas Tintin, oh boy, I love Tintin. There's just so much going on in there, so much story.
He used to go back, didn't he? He'd, after like 10 years, he'd go back and re-illustrate the older strips to re-correct, bring stuff up to date.
Yeah.
Which is quite...
So, I just love it. And none more so than, I think, possibly Voyage to the Moon.
Oh, yes.
Because that, the picture of, or the shooting star as well, but Voyage to the Moon, the picture of that rocket ship is so iconographic.
Yeah.
It just is gorgeous. I love it.
You forget, that rocket ship has become an icon of 1950s rocket. But you forget that Hergé drew that.
Yeah.
Just as part of the strip. And from there...
And I enjoyed the film, and I did enjoy the film, but there's something about reading the books, and it feels in the same way that somebody reading their first novel might read Dan Brown. And now how can I put this? And go, this is the best novel ever written, and it isn't. But there's something about reading Tintin where you sit there and it sucks you into a world where the words and the pictures work so well together that when you make that leap from reading a comic book which has very little in terms of writing and text and understanding that you've got to keep going on page after page, when you make that leap into there, it's like a whole new world opens. And actually, I think I'm doing Hergé down, comparing to Dan Brown, because to be honest, it is far better.
But... I think you're right. It's a surprisingly... I mean, you read Tintin and it's almost part of the visual landscape and you can flick through it because you feel you know it. But it is a massively visually literate experience.
Yeah. Well, it's political and it's geographic and every single panel's got a speech bubble in it. And actually, there's a lot of speech bubbles. There's a lot of text. I'm flicking through it now. Yeah, it's, and again, I love the fact that he's a writer and an artist at the same time. And I don't want to dismiss the guys who are just writers, and I don't want to dismiss the guys that are just artists. But somebody can do both of these things so well, I think is fabulous. I mean, Sam Keefe does the Mac so brilliantly, writing and drawing. Hergé with Tintin, the art is gorgeous and brilliant. The writing is fabulous to have the two things together. I think elevates it up a bit. And again, one of my comic book heroes that I love to pieces, Dave Sim, is a brilliant writer. And the writer, I'm not saying that I agree with his politics. And the only problem with Dave Sim is you have to say that after you say you love Dave Sim. You have to say I don't agree with the politics.
Isn't it?
And the same with Dave McKean, actually. I don't always agree with him, the stances he takes when he puts something across, and he's far less vitriolic than Dave Sim is. But Dave McKean, when he writes a story, it's a hell of a story. So Hergé, as a funny, It's funny. It's beautiful. It's brilliantly written. That's my better than Wave a Grave.
So somebody is deputised for next week to come up and do the case for Goscinny and Odurzo.
Well, can do. I mean, I would equally talk with love about Asterix. It's just a completely different thing for me.
Excellent. Good, good, good. Kelly, you stuck with the funnies.
I did, because this is actually one of my favorite ever, for a bunch of reasons, but it's Burke Breathed. Did you still have the record in it? Oh my God, I'm all distracted now.
Have I got the record? I don't know. I have the record. No, I haven't got the record. It was a plastic record. I've got it somewhere.
A flexi disc.
Yeah.
And it was You Stink, But I Love You.
Yes.
And it features Opus on the electric tube. I have the MP3. I'll send it to you.
That just warms my heart.
Now that's good radio.
Because you can't buy it. I would buy it again. I bought all these. I mean, this is why I had to take a break a minute ago and rearrange my desk, was so I had a place to put two of them, so I could show them to you. So this is just some art from Burke Breathed of Bloom County, and I'm going to show you the bit that I like the best is when he draws regular people. So I don't know how close you guys are going to be able to get. I'll put a couple pictures on the G+ community just to show you guys an example. But the regular folks in Burke Breathed comics, like in Bloom County and in Outland, they always crack me up. Now, of course, this one has Death Tongue at the bottom of it, so there you are. But I love the artwork, and I love that it was never particularly fancy to me, and this is probably the first comic of any sort that I ever read regularly. Like, I never cared about Garfield. I would see Peanuts once in a while on Sundays, but the thing that I wanted to read every single day was always Bloom County. Oh. So that was my first comic anything, and it will always hold a warm spot in my heart for that reason alone. But I just love... I love how all of his characters really, I know they're ridiculous, but they all seem really believable. Like, at one point, for the Bloom County Picayune Times, Opus becomes their comic strip person, and so they start referring to him as the staff stripper.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yes. And, like, when you read, you know, you see the almighty Basilope, and you kind of go, yeah, that could be a thing. And it's just something about the world that he built, particularly in Bloom County, that is really nice. And if you've ever seen any of, I almost said his solo stuff, any of his non-Bloom County art, he's done some children's books like A Wish for Wings That Work and the Red Rider one, and Mars Needs Moms was also originally his. And the art in those are an Edward Fudwhopper something. I can't remember the name of it. I have it, but it's not on my shelf right now, so I can't get it out and show it to you. But all of his other artwork is beautiful. And he was another one. You guys were talking about redoing comic strips. He talked about at length talked about getting stuff ready to do these. My pick this week, which is the complete library of Bloom County that comes in 5 volumes, and how he had to dig the original artwork out of a bunch of different places. Sometimes he had them, sometimes he didn't. And he remembered some of them, like finishing the sketch on the plane to go deliver the strips to the syndicate. And, it was really entertaining to see to hear some of those stories that he was telling about those. So he's my better than this week.
And he is too.
Oh.
So Jeff, you've got someone quite famous lined up.
I do, which for me is actually kind of out of character, because I have been picking people that are a little more obscure or at least not mainstream names. This week, however, I'm picking Matt Groening.
From here.
And, oh, that's right. He's from Kelly's part of the world. That's right. So
stick with the theme of doing the stuff that's non-obvious, you're just going to go for the Living in Hell strips.
Oh, yeah. Living in Hell is just brilliant.
Life in Hell is awesome. Loved
it. Yeah, it was fabulous, wasn't it? That's my favorite.
Yeah, Life in Hell.
Stuff.
Yeah. It's just absolutely wonderful. And there's so much in the stuff he draws without having hardly anything in the stuff he draws. And it's just wonderful and refreshing to pick up something that Matt Groening did that's not The Simpsons. Because, of course, everyone knows The Simpsons and knows that style. But seeing something that he's drawn where you can look at it and go, God, this looks really familiar. Because you can see in his older stuff the seeds that eventually become the style that's The Simpsons and Futurama. But Life in Hell is just magically wonderful. And Matt Groening just has this fantastic style that I think draws you in. It's not presumptuous, and it's very simple, and I think it's a wonderfully refreshing style of drawing.
It is. It's almost like an everyman comic, isn't it? You get the feeling it's one of those artists that you think I could do that, and obviously you can't because he is gifted beyond the norms of mortal men. But you know, you look at it and you think there's no artifice that he's hiding his art behind. Mm-hmm. It's just there. It's on the page and it works. And that's it.
Yes, the talent it takes to draw something that looks so simple that everyone says, "I can draw that." Mm. That says a lot about the artist. And if you try and match what Matt is doing, well, it becomes apparent very quickly that no, it's not simple. It's not something just anyone can do. This is Matt Groening. This is his thing. And we all just get to be thankful that we get to enjoy the artwork he creates for us.
Excellent. Good.
So here's a tidbit about The Simpsons I'll tell you guys, is that they're he used a lot of streets in Portland as the names for characters. So the street that runs all the way from the far side of West Portland to the far side of East Portland is – there now, you guys, I'm in frame is called Burnside, and that was Mr. Burns' original name. And Reverend Lovejoy, there's a Lovejoy Street, and there's
Are you going to tell us there's a Nahasima Petalon Avenue?
No, sadly. And like his dad's name was Homer. He went to the same high school that my parents-in-law went to. And he did. And then also there's a Flanders Street here, and we have it both on the west side of Portland in the north and on the east side of Portland in the north. And to this day, if you drive through certain parts of town, you can still find signs that have been defaced where people have added a D so that it will say Ned Flanders instead of Northeast Flanders.
That's awesome.
I love it.
Portland.
There's actually big Simpson news this week, is that the other guy that helped create The Simpsons, Sam Simon. Yeah, Sam Simon is basically giving all of his money to charity. He made shed loads off The Simpsons and took care of his family, and now he's taking the rest of it and divvying it up. He has terminal cancer and he wants to
A month to live, isn't it?
Something like 4 to 6 weeks, I think, was what I heard. And so he started his own foundation, and he's going to give some to PETA, and he's going to give some to a couple of Feed the Children sorts of organizations and some animal rights organizations who are less militant than PETA. So it's going to be good for him. I thought it was sort of sad and happy news at the same time, like to understand that there was something better to do now that he's taken care of all of his family and still has all this leftover cash. He found a really philanthropic use for it.
Yeah, because A, you can't take it with you, and B,
right,
you know, there's only so much you can give to your family before they've got enough.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was it. I thought it was impressive, and since The Simpsons came up, I wanted to make sure we
excellent
tossed it out there.
No, I read that, and I thought, yeah, that's pretty cool. Pretty cool. I mean, I'm not perhaps PETA as an organization. They're maybe a little radical for my blood, but
for most people's tastes, I think.
Yeah, but and you could see where Lisa Simpson's, you know, PETA Petter, Peter Petter thing comes from. I've gone back to last week. We touched on who is my better than Wavy Davy pick was Tank Girl. Mm-hmm. And I picked that as an example of a decent stab or a differentiated stab at women in comics and things. But I'm going to go back. How unreconstructed is my pick? I've got to get my apologies in right now. It's like there is nothing about Jamie Hewlett's artwork that is not unreconstructed. But the anarchy, the energy, the excitement, the faces. I'm going to go with the faces because the faces are quite cool, and the feet. Everything in the middle is also, I guess, up for grabs. But anyway, faces and feet for me. But Jamie Hewlett, the original creator of Tank Girl, and obviously Gorillaz with Damon Albarn. And what's weird about the energy that Jamie Hewlett puts into his artwork is that if you listen to a Gorillaz track in conjunction with watching Jamie Hewlett's artwork, it's awesome and it's brilliant music. And then for the last world tour, the Gorillaz stepped out of the limelight and they had the musicians on the stage and they played live mm-hmm. as people. And it all just fell apart. And it was like, how much of that music is held together by the pure energy of Jamie Hewlett's illustration? And it's a lot of it. I mean, mm-hmm. I know Tank Girl, lover, hater, post-punk, riot girl, all that kind of like stuff. Yeah, at the end of the day, she's a girl that's dating a kangaroo and she drives a tank and and there's some stuff
as
going
one
on there,
does
as you do in post-apocalyptic Australia, but just the playing around with the form of the busting out of panels, the stuff that Jamie Hewlett did on the page, it was like a kind of a madman let loose with a crayon. Brilliant.
Definitely.
The thing I love about Hewlett is he has so many pictures that are, if you look at the Making of Gorillaz book that they did, or whatever, or any of the Gorillaz box sets that you can buy, there are so many pictures that he did, and yet each one is a finished, beautiful piece of art. Mm. And even the pencils have a finished look to them, which is fabulous. So, yeah, Jamie Hewlett, I mean, especially Gorillaz, I love them. I don't like rap, I don't like hip-hop, and I still love Gorillaz. There's something about them that transcends the music.
And it's his artwork.
But Damon Albarn, I think, is a thunderously good writer of music. And Blur is fabulous. Sure. So his words, Hewlett's artwork, really good mix of two people who are equally talented but in completely different genres.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, excellent. And I think that in opposition to the bit that gets me about other artists' work is the kind of the buttoned down bit. Mm. Even the in some ways the Brian Bolland thing, which Kelly, he was a pick last week for Kelly, and Brian Bolland is perhaps the ultimate draftsman in comics. So much energy, so much patience and things into nailing things directly on the page, and then Jamie Hewlett comes along and just goes, bah!
Yeah,
bollocks. On it goes, whatever.
Yep.
And some of the stuff, you realise that he's drawn it wrong and he's lost interest. And, you'd get pages where he'd get halfway down a figure and he'd just give up and go, not interested in that anymore. Just going to slap another page in there and do something else. And just almost like stream of consciousness art. And then tightened up with the inks to look really finished.
Well, there's a raw feeling to his art, which I think is really cool.
Yes. But bizarrely mainstream. I mean, obviously he was the right person at the right time, and it's he became with Tank Girl he became totally mainstream. Gorillaz obviously completely mainstream. So
mm-hmm.
So we're gonna ostensibly we are talking about the comic strips and the funnies and things. Last week we did a good 15-20 minutes on Calvin and Hobbes, so I don't propose to bring the mighty god that is Bill Watterson back up again. I think we can just assume that they'd like less than, greater than thing. Calvin and Hobbes, greater than, everything else, less than Calvin and Hobbes.
Done. There's just no debating it.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading online earlier a bit about Calvin and Hobbes in the strip, and they said, oh, you know, it was Will Watterson retired Calvin and Hobbes essentially 10 years ago now. And basically they said, and nothing has filled the space that it left since. And I think that's probably accurate. It's like, it's been, it's finished, it's gone, and that space that it occupied is empty and is likely to remain empty. Yeah.
But I don't know that there was a space for it before, honestly. I think there's a few comics that carve out their spot, and then when they're gone, nothing fills that space. But it wasn't like that was a space that was being filled previously. Like, no, with Peanuts as an example.
Do you know what? When you say that Calvin Hobbes is the high watermark, I'm not arguing, but I don't know that Peanuts isn't the high watermark. And for me, if I had to choose only one, I would choose Peanuts.
Yeah.
There is something so beautifully bittersweet about the entire world of Charlie Brown and all of his friends. And I love Calvin and Hobbes, but Calvin and Hobbes at the end of the day are two characters in the family and the girl down lane and whatever. And there's something about Peanuts where it was a world and a lot of families and, you know, the little red-headed girl and everything like that. I like Peanuts more than Calvin and Hobbes, think about it. I'm not going to get outvoted on that one, but I love Peanuts.
I love them both and in different ways. You know, it's like what I assume it would be when you're a parent and you have two kids that are very different and people say, which one do you love more? Well, I love both of them, but in different ways.
Oh, I was going to say, which one cost me the least amount of money this week?
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, there's that too.
There's that too. Yeah.
But I mean, the Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes are so unique, and I would not want to have to choose between the two. I love the adventure and innocence in Calvin and Hobbes. Oh. And I love that melancholy world of Charlie Brown as well. It's because there are things I can relate to on a very profound level in both.
Yep. You could totally see a mashup of the two happening.
For me, weirdly, one of the things that I loved about Peanuts was watching Charles Schulz's line work get older as he got older.
That's true, it totally aged with him.
Slightly shaky, and you know, and it was a clean cut, you know, the early ones were full of energy and vibrant and things, and then there's kind of like a middle period where he was middle-aged, or you know, 30 to 40 50 and things, and it was very well done, and it was the draftsmanship was superb and the stories were excellent. And then as he started to age, you know, a little bit of shakiness, and then the later ones, you know, really shaky, and I loved that. I loved the story of his life as an artist in the strip really liked that.
Well, and it was tied so closely to his life. Like within 24 hours or something of submitting the final Peanuts strip was when he passed away, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yes, it was ridiculous, wasn't it? He retired. He sent in the last strip, and I think 24, 48 hours later he died.
I mean, yeah, it was very close together.
And we have so much from Schulz, because we do have years and years worth of stories.
But also in America, we got TV.
Yep. That's true. Yep. And then, so then we had the specials, which
the
two good ones, which would be Christmas and Halloween.
Yes.
And those were just brilliant animated interpretations of what Charles Schulz had created.
And they were doomed. For people who don't know, it's like the epic saga of getting these made, particularly the Christmas one, because they bring the entire thing to a complete halt so that Linus can tell the story of Christmas and how that was so terrible to try to put on television. And these things are voiced by actual little kids, and sometimes they blew the line and you know, but that's what kids actually sounded like. I didn't ever see like the issue with it. But I've read a couple of books where they talked about making the specials and how nobody's ever done this and how are we going to make this work? And like, it's all the classic overcoming story. You know, at every turn he was doomed to fail, and at every turn he was doomed to fail, and something happened, and it went his way, like, every time. And it was just so many things that lined up perfectly in order to get The Great Pumpkin on the air and to get the Charlie Brown Christmas special on the air. And it's another one of those commentary track things that, like, it's just fascinating to,
actually, that,
to know
I'm
the tragedy of it.
I am totally going into Wikipedia to check this out later. I would love to see more of this. I'll tell you what, though, without the animation, with the animations, I cannot, I can't read the comics without the music. And actually, the voices, I think the voices are perfect for the characters, but that jazz piano soundtrack is lovely.
Oh, yeah, that's true. If you want to have that full experience, you go out and you start buying up Vince Guaraldi's work, and just have that playing in the background.
I think it's probably fair to say, although, you know, to go back a step, we have the love for Calvin and Hobbes and things, that I think perhaps it would you say that if there was a newspaper strip that was indisputably in the history of newspaper strips, the king, I mean, it's going to be Peanuts, isn't it? It really is.
Mm-hmm. No question.
Yes.
Yep, yeah, I'll go with you.
It was
that.
In everybody's paper for so many years. I mean, I think Calvin and Hobbes, like, there were a lot of people who didn't read the paper when Calvin and Hobbes was out. And I think there's a certain amount of that. And because the newspaper as a medium has continued to sort of decline, and people who read it aren't necessarily people who are going to read the comics. That's the other sort of tragedy of being relegated to the comic page. I think that's where a lot of people are pleased about collections and things, because I think that Calvin and Hobbes probably picked up a lot of new fans as a result of somebody handing over one of these little books and going, not this one, but going, here, you should totally read this because these are really funny. Mm-hmm. I think Foxtrot has some of the spirit of Calvin and Hobbes in the, like, there's a lot of joy, and then fundamentally there's a lot of love between everybody, even though they all drive each other insane, which just makes it accurate. And
there's
I think and it's not filling that space. It's not filling the space that Calvin and Hobbes, I think, created, but it is doing something that I think is different and nice. And it's another one where they're all sort of the same. It's not like, for better or worse, when everybody, like, ages in real time, the way that the comic book, the way that people reading do, or, you know, some of the other ones that are more sort of serial like that. I think, didn't Kathy end up eventually getting married or something? And like, there's all these different ones that are like real time stuff where things have evolved, and that hasn't been the case here. I would say the one that I would look forward to, if I still got the Sunday paper, of the stuff that I know is currently still running in the Sunday comics, Foxtrot would be the one that I would look forward to.
You know, I'm having a really hard time getting excited about any of the current newspaper comic strips. It's there was a point for me when I started to get disappointed. So, you know, so we didn't have Calvin and Hobbes anymore. Bloom County was gone, and then we had the replacement, which I just totally blanked out on the name.
Outland,
which I had a horrible time trying to get into and finally gave up on. And then Doonesbury started changing.
Don't you feel? I always felt with Doonesbury that you should like it. And Gary Trudeau is obviously, you know, a good writer, and there's some, you know, some good comment on there. But I don't know. I never felt any love for Doonesbury.
See, I think the golden years for Doonesbury were in the 1980s.
They totally were.
And I relished Doonesbury in the 80s. And as soon as they would release a compilation of the previous couple years, I would rush out to the bookstore and buy it so that I could sit down and just read.
Binge.
And just binge and relive the strips. I just I could not get enough of it. And then in the 90s, it started changing, and I had to learn to let go of a lot because because I had to let Doonesbury go. I couldn't get into Outland, and there when Zippy the Pinhead became a newspaper comic, I thought, oh my God, here's something that's so avant-garde that I've been reading in all of these underground papers, and this is going to be so awesome to finally have this. Oh crap, it's just mainstream. And that was it. And so then I lost Zippy the Pinhead also. And then I had this horrible fear that that Life in Hell would suddenly become a mainstream comic and I would lose that too.
But whilst you were sort of getting onto in the 80s to Doonesbury, which is obviously was a golden age because you had Reagan and things and all that stuff was easy to satirize, and there was a lot of that stuff. I remember the Doonesbury strips from the mid 80s and stuff. And we had over on our side of the pond, we had If, didn't we, Paul? By Steve Bell, who was the.
Steve Bell is the UK equivalent of Doonesbury, a much more scatological, much more harsh as a political outcome, I think.
Yes, but they were both carried by The Guardian, weren't they? So they were kind of stacked on top of each other, Doonesbury and If. And If was, I mean, If in UK political terms, If was the. Did Steve Bell introduce the. He introduced the world to the idea of John Major wearing his underpants over his trousers. And he went through the 80s with this mad, mad, swivel eyed Margaret Thatcher with eyeballs that never pointed in the same direction at once. And, you know, it was quite.
She was Britain's Bill the Cat.
Yes. And he's, I think, to you know, just like Doonesbury, I think that Steve Bell has struggled with New Labour and New Conservatism and consensus politics and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the political guys, they need good characters to do something with. And we just don't necessarily have those anymore.
No.
We'll give you some of ours.
We're giving you one of ours. Is not David Miliband heading over your side of the pond?
Is he?
So I remember to go down the list that we've got in discussion. And when I was growing up and I was learning to draw and things, one of the strips that really inspired me as an idea of how simple you could get it and how exciting things or interesting and funny and clever. The words in comic strips could be was BC and It, Wizard of Id, which again fallen out of favor. And reading back on it, a lot of it hasn't translated in times. Do you think, you know, Johnny Hart? I mean, was he a guy of his time, or
you know, part of what makes so many of the strips popular, I think, is that they're written contemporaneously, meaning that they totally work for that moment in time, and that's perfectly fine. And so that's why stuff like Wizard of Id, I think, totally worked. Why Beetle Bailey worked, and why Blondie worked, because they could fit a specific time. When that shelf life was over, then it just wasn't the same. And that's okay too. They could have their special time, and then there are other comic strips that have something special, something so much more, and we always come back to the same two. That would be Calvin and Hobbes and Peanuts.
Yes, they're basically timeless and things. I mean, I remember weirdly, you know, as for four panels that are about a bunch of cavemen living in the middle of nowhere, you'd think that would be a reasonably timeless strip. And BC obviously has continued for a long time, but looking back on it now, it has a sort of a definite feel for its time in terms of the humour. And I think perhaps Wizard of Id has dated even more.
And the thing about Wizard of Id and BC,
sorry, go ahead. Just pacing, like you have to be a lot quicker now with getting to your point and everything, and I think that just the pace of telling a joke is also very different now in print than it used to be.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and another strip. Sorry.
Paul's trying to talk.
Paul, you talk and then I'll talk.
Okay, now all I was going to say was the Wizard of Oz and BC I loved, but the formula was far stricter than the formula is in Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes and so on. In Calvin and Hobbes, you would have three or four one-liner jokes going through sequential series. But then you get, I was reading through it because on Facebook there's a Calvin and Hobbes page of the day that I've been reading recently. You know, the podcast has reminded me to read more Calvin and Hobbes, which is a good thing. And I've just got to the bit where their house is burgled and Calvin thinks that Hobbes has been stolen. And that is heartbreaking, and it's so good. And there's seven or eight strips where there is not one joke, there is just emotion.
Aftermath.
And raw emotion.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the parents are real parents dealing with their house being broken into. And it's not funny, but it's beautifully drawn and beautifully realised. And it's great. Whereas Wizard of Oz and BC, I was going through a couple of books earlier thinking, is there a point where they've ever dealt with a serious emotion, a point in which the characters are dealing with a crisis or something bigger than the joke that happens on every page? And on every page it is, somebody says something back, somebody says the punchline, and that's it. And it becomes, it's dated in the same way that you would say something like Benny Hill has dated, because a joke is still funny and a joke is timeless. But if all you do is do a joke and then another joke and another joke and another joke, you get this repetition of humour that you need to have a bit of drama so that the next joke comes in just to the point where you stop laughing, you've caught your breath, and then you laugh again harder.
Yeah, I think that with Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes, a lot of the funny comes back from when Schultz and Watterson do tell a gag, that the gag they tell is preceded and based on weeks and weeks of character development and history that they will not ignore. And you tell a gag and you think the gag payoff line, whether it's Calvin or Hobbes or whether it's like Charlie Brown or Linus or whatever saying it, is as soon as they say that, you just instantly buy into the character as it has been created over the last number of years. Whereas with BC, it's like funny, funny, funny. It's like Friends. La la la, la ha ha.
Yeah.
La la
yeah,
la,
yeah.
ha ha.
Yeah, there's no depth.
No. Although the artwork is, yeah, and I do think Johnny Hart is very good in that respect with the artwork. But in terms of the concept of the strip, perhaps didn't move it on. We've got a couple more, and looking through the show notes, I mean, one of them is very UK-centric, and we won't really dwell on it because I'm guessing that probably Jeff and Kelly haven't really heard about it, which was Fluke.
I've never seen it. I'm just looking it up now, actually, funnily enough.
But, I mean, artwork, awesome, gorgeous artwork, but the creators, I mean, you're talking about Humphrey Littleton, you're talking about Wally Fawkes, you're talking about, you know, this is Barry Took. In terms of British writing talent, there's some serious talent in this.
I'll tell you what it reminds me of. And I know it's going back to one of your favourites as well, but it's absolutely got a Where the Wild Things Are. Look to it.
Yes.
But if you're talking about things that have aged, oh my goodness, that has aged.
Yes, it has. It's a very, very political strip, so obviously all the political stuff has completely fallen over. But yeah. God, everything's firing up again.
And let me just point out about Bloom County, as I look forward to everybody's letters, I understand that it is absolutely a comic of its time. It is absolutely, by and large, super topical. But all of the adventure and stuff, like whenever they were with Cutter John and they were all playing Star Trek, and when Opus got married, and when they started the band, and that time Bill the Cat died, and then that other time Bill the Cat died, and then that other time Bill the Cat died. Like, all of the stuff that goes on there is funny, and like, you know, the conflict between Oliver and his dad. And you know, like, what kind of is my place in the world and all those things. Like, those pieces still hold up to me. And I'm also always going to have a warm spot in my heart for Bloom County because there was no internet when these all were initially released. And so they would make a joke about Gene Kirkpatrick, or they'd make a joke about Pat Robertson, or they'd make a joke about something Reagan had said, or make fun of some sort of foreign policy. And I wouldn't know what that was because I was in, like, fifth grade. I have no idea idea who Jean Kirkpatrick is. I would go look it up. I would go down to the library and I'd like write. I would like take notes when I was reading Bloom County of the stuff I didn't get. And then I would go down to the library and I would go read like Time Magazine and Newsweek. And I subscribed to Newsweek Magazine as a very, very young person. I probably screwed up their entire demographic because I wanted to know this stuff and I was curious. Mm. And when you live in the wilderness, having a delivery each week of a window into a whole nother world of the stuff that's happening outside of where you are is really fantastic. And Bloom County was what did that for me. Cause at first it was like penguin. And then like it turned into something so much bigger. And so for me, that's always going to be the thing about Bloom County that makes it near and dear to my heart. I totally don't think most of it, I think it has aged well, but I don't think it necessarily holds up. You can't make those same jokes today just by taking out Jean Kirkpatrick and putting in Sarah Palin or whoever. Like, you don't have that kind of option because it's very specific stuff. But I do still really like to read those. And but my favorites are the stuff like Let's Go Free the Animals from the Mary Kay Factory and those kind of things.
I was just going to skip through. We've got other bits and bobs we've done going through because we're going to miss out on stuff. I mean, there's two that we haven't touched on, the big strips in terms of like everyone thinks. One of them is the nerd's favorite, Dilbert. We'll get back to Dilbert in a second. And the other one is Garfield. Can we do a straw poll? Garfield, you know, I can feel my teeth grating as I even say the word. But do we love it? Is it good? Was it a good strip?
Garfield had moments. So if you cherry pick out of Garfield, you can find some really good stuff. But you have to know which pieces to read because there's a lot of chaff to go with that wheat. The coolest Garfield, though, and I just thought of this and totally forgot the name of it. There's the guy that's been going back and taking the speech bubbles out of Garfield.
It's Garfield minus Garfield.
Yes. That's right. Garfield minus Garfield. And that is brilliant. And it shows that there's this underlying brilliance in Garfield. And I can't believe I just said that. But
because now John is just a crazy guy that talks to himself.
Yes. Right.
Like the cat just sits there. There's no thought balloon for Garfield's reply. So he's just some dude that comes in and he's like, I got a date tonight. And
but
then,
it's better like, than the strip.
It's dark.
I mean, when you take... When you start taking the Garfield speech bubbles out, it becomes this very dark, depressing story of this isolated man who just really can't function well with other people.
Yeah, because he stays home all the time talking to his pets.
Yes.
Yeah. And can I put a different point of view to it, which is I loved Garfield at a time in my life and then I grew out of it. And I think the thing with the funnies is all of the ones that we're mentioning hit you at different ages. When you're older, you might like Doonesbury. You should not be younger when you read Steve Bell. Bloom County is sort of in the middle ground. It's this beautifully realised childhood landscape plus the adults, whereas Peanuts is the kids. And I think all of them hit you at different age groups. Garfield, I loved when I was a kid, and I thought it was a really fabulous comic strip. But there was a point where I grew out of it, and I was totally out of it.
I think I get offended by the whole Garfield. For me, it's like the anti-Calvin and Hobbes. It's like, you know, there's Bill Watterson. He's taking his holidays. He's demanding that he gets the full page in a Sunday. He's drawing everything by hand. He's colouring everything by hand. And there's Jim Davis walking in and going, well, what have you got for me today? And the guy's going, well, we wrote this and this and this. And this guy going, yeah, just pull like panel 4 of like strip 27, reprint that and add that to that. Mm. It's like, you know, Garfield is the ultimate factory strip.
It's just like, I hate to say it. Is it the wavy grave of funnies then?
Yeah, it is. It's just like, you know, it's a bunch of people in a workshop churning out funny.
Mm.
But, you know. And some, you know, people still swear by it, so you know maybe they're right, and maybe I'm just a kind of complete mentalist banging my head on the table.
It was one of the first merchandising comics. I mean, like there weren't like a lot of Peanuts dolls and stuff that you could really get before Garfield in the 80s turned into the suction cups on the car windows.
Oh, yeah.
And T-shirts and a book and then a book and then a collection of the books, which were each a collection of strips and all the toys and the candy dispenser. And like, I think probably Hallmark had a whole section at one point that was just stuffed with Garfield on it. I think that is probably part of why Garfield is so much part of the public consciousness.
Yeah. And then the films, which were, well, let's not mention the films.
No. We've already made Andrew ill enough as it is. We don't want to make it worse.
So we're gonna go from Garfield to Dilbert. There's a whole bit in the show notes which is about web comics. But you know what? We're gonna do web comics next week
separately.
Mm. That sounds like a good plan, just in general.
It does, doesn't it? But I think you know, we're a podcast. We're computer nerds. It's a comic strip. Dilbert.
Well, and Dilbert is awesome twice, I think, because. Scott Adams started drawing it while he still had a day job. Mm. And so he was Dilbert going to work every day and doing ridiculous things for a horrible boss at a sucky job and then coming home. And he did that for a long time until Dilbert really kicked off. And so I think that's also a part of what makes Dilbert special if you're a nerd, is because he was off being someone else's monkey until he managed to turn this into something that really worked for him, Scott Adams, personally. And I think that really is a great moment, you know, for a lot of people that they can point to. But then also, you know, it is nerdy. It spent a lot of time making a lot of jokes that regular folks may not even get. So I think that was the other thing about it that was very cool.
You know, when I worked in a print shop, I loved Dilbert because I was in an office and I was dealing with other people. And I was the guy that had been tasked with managing all of the IT for the company. Mm-hmm. And so I would read Dilbert and it was like I was being spoken to directly. And as soon as I left and started my own consulting business, I lost interest in Dilbert because I didn't have that tie to the strip anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing just how quickly I lost interest.
Well, and the thing, you know, I think the character in it is nice and it's all very clever, but it's very much the other people piece of it that really makes Dilbert work. And it, like interview after interview, Scott Adams has even said, people ask me constantly how I manage to portray their job, their company as well as I do. And he said, I never went anywhere. This is just all stuff that happened to me. So I think the other thing about Dilbert that sort of makes that is that it's another one that's not particularly trendy. So I don't know how well it's going to age. It's been around for a little while. I don't know if it's going to be around, how much longer it's going to continue. But I think it's interesting to see how well it's going to age. I kind of look forward to seeing how it turns out over time. Because it's another one that's sort of timeless. It doesn't rely on Reagan jokes or Bush jokes or, you know, anything that's sort of topical. It relies on interpersonal humor, which is usually something that doesn't tend to go away.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it definitely has that. And, you know, for the huge number of people, the workplace humor and things is part of their daily life. And you can get that person, you can totally see that from the feedback he gets from his strip, the number of people that are living his life. I'm not sure that it comes from a particularly clever place, other than having lived that life. But maybe that's valid. I think maybe it's as a social commentary strip, it's of its time. It's of, you know, maybe, you know, other strips, Calvin and Hobbes, fantastical, Peanuts, a bittersweet, you know, childhood place, Dilbert,
you know, the people have grown up through their stages and they've gone to work and they've Dilbert's ready and waiting for them to say, yeah, I'm here. This is what you're experiencing. This is the funny side of that. But, you know, Scott Adams is a weird guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes the whole thing work for him. If he didn't have that weirdness, mm-hmm. well, then it would just be some guy writing stupid office comics.
Have we lost Paul? We have, haven't we?
Just come back now.
Ah, cool. Excellent.
I think another piece of it is that you have to be that person, like Jeff was saying. You have to be that person in order to enjoy it. Just like if you've never had a job behind a register, you will never appreciate the movie Clerks the way people who have actually appreciate it. And it's the same sort of thing. If you've never had that ridiculous boss, or you've never worked in that soul-sucking company, or you've never had to go report to a horrifying job like every single day, I don't think it's something that will please you in the way that it pleases people who do have that and need that outlet.
It's definitely, I think, in terms of workplace comics, it's the only one I can think of that is, you know, rooted in the day-to-day workplace of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So
I can't think of another.
No, I can't. And I don't know whether it's the, you know, the fact that it's the geek, yeah, the large number of geek people, the community that are behind it, the, you know, all the engineers, all the IT support, all the people that, I mean, that is a big section of the community and they're all behind Dilbert. But yeah, definitely it's
you probably said it when I was offline, but I think the other thing about it is Wally is the guy that we would all love to be in the office. I would love, and unfortunately, the manager in Dilbert is every manager I've ever had. And there's such a universal truth to it. Every time I come out of I'm not saying about my current workplace, obviously, but every time I used to come out of a meeting with my managers, I would be saying in my mind the things that Wally says, and I wish to hell I'd been saying them at the time when I was talking to the manager. And it's just reminded me of when I, years ago, one of the computer games companies I worked in, not saying which one, but it had the nuttiest boss who used to, he was just a complete fruitcake, and the internet would go off and he'd sort of like open the door and shout, "Is the web on?" in a comedy voice. He'd shut the door without listening to a reply, and then we'd be all saying that throughout the rest of the week. He came up with some humdingers. And I was in one meeting. Oh, yeah. And there was one day he came in to tell us all that we were going to be shutting up shop where we were working and possibly moving all the way up to Leamington Spa, which is a long old journey, required us, you know, relocating. And he did it in such a cack-handed fashion. It was like The Office with Dave Brent. And we were just all sitting there trying not to laugh, even though he was giving us news that we didn't want. And he called us all into his office to sort of like then talk about the mechanics of moving and changing workplace and how they'd help us assist us moving. And I was, even though it was a really serious conversation, I was trying not to be fits of giggles because he had the most ludicrous tile and the most ludicrous wallpaper behind him, and he was the epitome of the manager in Dilbert. And I thought, it is so universally true. The managers are just complete muppets and morons in most of the places that I worked at, and I want to be Wally. That's what I want to say to people.
I'm going to say an overarching thing to draw this. We're going to do pics in a minute, and we're going to do web comics next week because there's so much stuff on web comics and things. So we'll do that. It's a separate thing. I think that, you know, we've touched on stuff that's good, like BC, Wizard of Id, Foxtrot, Doonesbury, and things that has a time from things. And there's stuff that goes on and on and on. And I suspect Dilbert will join Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes in the on and on and on thing. Purely for that universal truth thing. I think Calvin and Hobbes is the universal truth of childhood.
Yep.
Peanuts is the universal truth of perhaps growing up. And Dilbert is the universal truth of working.
of the workplace.
Yes, yeah, of the workplace. Yep, definitely. Yes, of the workplace. Yep. So I think, and of the other strips we've touched on, none of those, you know, good, bad, indifferent, Garfield. there's like, there's no truth, nothing. There's no underlying truth, you know, underpinning their universe. So with that bizarrely deep thought, because I finished my bottle of wine and I've only got a little bit left, so
podcast over.
We're going to go on with the picks. We'll next week we'll return with web comics, but picks of the week this week. I'm going to throw two, which is a technical term, which means I'm going to ask Paul to come up with next step. So you're, I can't believe I've read it. Go on. What have you got?
Well, my funny is a modern recreation of one of the funnies that is one of my most favourite and most cherished and adored, which is Popeye. Mm. And way before I was into comics, I think, I can't remember which happened first, but I was into animation. And I love the Max Fleischer Popeye cartoons. And then I started reading the sequential, the series of Popeye cartoons, and the whole Sagar and Sackendorf, the family, the Thimble Theatre, everything about Popeye I loved. And I love the artwork, I love the story, excellent stuff. So recently IDW started doing a Mars Attacks mashup, and over the weeks they would have Mars Attacks something else, and it was Mars Attacks Zombies versus Robots, Mars Attacks, Kiss, Mars... I can't remember the other ones that they had. And I was really hoping they were building up to Mars Attacks Judge Dredd, because he was in their stable of comics. But the problem with it was they started with the best one of the series by far, which is Mars Attacks Popeye. And it is so good. It is absolutely brilliant. It is pitch-perfect period piece for both Popeye and Mars Attacks. It is utterly, utterly brilliant. The artwork looks like it stepped off the page of the best of best classic Popeye. the Mars Attacks character beautifully in. The Sea Hag is in the comic driving up the force. Mars Attacks versus Popeye, it is... The new stuff is the stuff. It's so perfectly done. Absolutely love and adore it. And it is laugh out loud funny in places. So that is my pick of the week. Way, way, way up there. And I hope they do IDW, you know, the Mars Attacks versus, yeah, whoever's next. Well, but I really want them to do Mars Attacks versus Popeye.
There's some pretty solid Mars Attacks versus Dread artwork on Google, so...
Okay, maybe they did too. I didn't notice it.
Yeah, I'm thinking
it's a limited... Okay, I'm going to have to check that out. Mm. I didn't see it on Comixology, but I will check. Maybe it's like a phase two or something. I have no idea.
Excellent. Looking at that and thinking, yep, I want to watch that. But that all looks superb. And I was looking at Mars Attacks versus that, Mars Attacks versus Dread. Yeah, brilliant. Mm. Endless. Kelly, what have you got for us? We've already seen your... pick earlier, haven't we?
We have, and now I'm all distracted because I went to look at the images for Mars Attacks Popeye, and I found Mars Attacks Opus, and so now I'm all distracted. My pick is Bloom County, and I'm actually going to expand my pick. I was initially going to have it be the complete library, pick up any of those, but it doesn't have to be the complete library. Now, they are beautiful hardback editions with the little ribbon bookmark in them, and it is literally every single strip. And they're cool because they come with commentary. This is one of the things that I like about this that we've already talked about is the director's cut of stuff. I don't remember if it's the complete Calvin and Hobbes or not, but there's a couple Calvin and Hobbes where Waterston goes in and fills in some commentary. And those are some of my favorite moments of all of them. And so I really like, and I also really like Burke Breathed because I like listening to him go, I straight up copied Doonesbury. Like right at the beginning, he says, like, I just wanted to draw something that was half as good as Doonesbury. And so that's why my early stuff looks like maybe maybe Gary Trudeau started drawing with his other hand, and that's what you get.
And but I like, so appreciate that, because that is the trap that I fall into, and I'm busy falling into it at the moment, is that, you know, I'm draw stuff, and then I see someone and I think, God, that's brilliant. Maybe I could amend my style to be more like them.
Yeah. So he said he came flat out and said, like, I started out totally copying, and then it sort of turned into its own thing. And so if you can find any Bloom County or Opus Treasury, not necessarily the Outland stuff is neat, but it's one of those sort of fan service things. Like, you really have to be into it to be into it. Any Bloom County collection that you find at a yard sale, used at Powell's, on Amazon, whatever, pick one up and you won't be sorry. And particularly the two that stand out to me are Night of the Mary Kay Commandos and Billy and the Boingers Bootleg. Those are two of the better collections. So if you're looking for like one shot of a big dose of Bloom County, that would be it. Or any of the Burke Breathed books. He did kids books, and those are good as well. So I have to go find Mars Attacks Opus now.
Yeah, if I can get that through Comixology, I am so downloading it as soon as we're done recording.
I know.
Yeah.
Just I said the Mars Attacks Opus cover, and I was like, yeah, buy it. Don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Once again.
So that's my pick. Good. It's lovely.
Excellent. Jeff, you're going to do what in the podcasting and stand-up trade we call a callback to something you mentioned earlier in the episode.
That's true. I was thinking of everything I did before as foreshadowing. So my pick of the week is Life in Hell from Matt Groening. And it's just – well, I have waxed poetic about this throughout the entire episode today. So, yeah, there you go. It's just – wonderful, and the characters are fantastic. One of the things that I love is that you have these characters that are clearly one thing, but then they're not. Then they're something else, but then they're not, and that's okay. And like Akbar and Jeff.
Akbar and Jeff.
Yeah, I mean,
I love Akbar and Jeff.
They're friends, but maybe not. But they're relatives, but maybe not. They're guys or girls, or maybe not. And they're lovers sometimes, maybe not. And it doesn't matter, because you can do so much with these characters. And clearly Matt Groening did. So.
And the Akbar and Jeff ones are the ones that stand out to me as really, like, if I was going to have somebody go binge on Life in Hell, that's what it would be. Is I would just go like get a stack of Akbar and Jeff ones and hand that to them and go, start here, and then you can go read about the other stuff, because the Akbar and Jeff stuff is like, as it's like the IKEA comic. It's like super super minimal, and it's like as stripped down as it can be, and whatever you bring to it is what makes it a funny thing for you.
Yes, yeah, there you go. The very first Life in Hell strips that I saw were actually with Binky, which is the anthropomorphic rabbit. And I was just drawn in. And lucky for me, within like a day of seeing a couple of the Binky strips, someone showed me the Akbar Jeff, a couple of those. And I'm like, oh my God. And then it just became this quest to go and find as much Life in Hell as I could. So yes, go on the hunt, my little minions, and read as much Life in Hell as you can.
Do. Yes. Because it's a good backstop to The Simpsons and Futurama, and B, it's good in its own self. So I thought I was going to cheat again. With my pick, but I'm not cheating, because it is actually a comic strip, which I'm quite pleased by. Obviously, most people are familiar with The Moomins as the books by Tove Jansson. I guess I grew up with them. Paul, you probably grew up with them. And you get there's the stories, which are brilliant, and you get the occasional picture, which is also brilliant, because Tove Jansson is a super supreme draftsman, person. But she also produced the Moomin comic strips, which are collected into 6 volumes in hardcover, which you can buy. And I would say don't buy volume 1 or 2 or 3, just buy all 6 volumes. Uh-huh. Because it's a journey into one woman's mind, her, you know. I think last week and the week before, when we do picks for artists, one of the things that I'm conscious of that I always pick is artists that will draw with a total fluidity of line, that they're confident that everything they draw is absolutely right. And I pick these people because everything I draw is not that way. I, you know, if I draw stuff, I have to work so hard at making sure that a line goes where I want it to go, and I have to try 2, 3, 4 times to get that. And if anyone is an artist, and if I can see that they've drawn one line and it's gone in one place and it could never go anywhere else, that's, for me, that is it. And Tove Jansson is like, she, you know, you could have handed her like a foot wide crayon and she would have put it with point accuracy into, you know, she physically incapable of drawing anything that is not exactly where it's not supposed to be. As a draftsperson, she's utterly incomparable. And she's coupled that with this beautiful poetic license, you know, vocabulary, this totally evocative creation of this like Scandinavian landscape and Scandinavian folklore and characters, and the books are great because it's all in the text and you can read that and it's lovely, but the comic strips, which she did from the 50s onwards, are in some ways even better because it's panel after panel of this most beautiful artwork. Totally stunning artwork. It just, you know, I can read a Moomin, the collected Moomin books, and it just, it, you know, I'm done as a, you know, that's it. There's nothing, you know, it's to distill the essence of the Moomin characters, to distill the essence of the characters that she's written so much about. And she's obviously, you know, in the books, there's a lot of words and they're all good words, but to distill that into the bullet points and the bubbles of comic strip, and to expand, for me, the illustrations out of the illustrations into comic strip is just, it's just awesome, I think. And there's nowhere else to go for me from that. I think for me, it's where it's at. And I would say go to your, they're not difficult to find because they're collected and they're easy to buy. £8-10 buys you each volume. And perhaps you don't want to buy all 6 volumes in one go, but go and buy the first volume and read it. Have I eulogised enough yet?
Oh, no, you could go on for ages. Volumes. I love the artwork. So yeah. Yes, no.
Beautiful artwork. Yep. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And it's just, if anyone has ever succeeded, you know, you talked about Hergé, which is a brilliant synergy of the artwork and the storyline, in a bizarrely, uniquely Belgian. And I've had a very Belgian day today, so... No, I have. Weird, but I have had a Belgian day today, which has gone from waffles to people that I know in Belgium and workers. Anyway, very Belgian day, and Hergé's come up as well, so that's quite... is it synergistic or syzygy? Anyway, one or the other. But Hergé is the distillation. There's a lot of Belgian sensibility in Hergé, and you know, the essence of the Moomins and Tove Jansson is this Finnish and Scandinavian sensibility, which is just seeped into the strip every panel. There we go. That's my pick for today.
Yeah, very nice.
And having gone on and on in the most spectacular fashion about that, I'm going to go back to my Google document and find out where we are, because I think we're probably done.
We're done.
I'm going to push the boat out and guess that we went over the hour and a half.
A minute.
By the time we edit, no.
We didn't even touch web comics.
No. We have so much to talk about already. Yeah.
So we've got 2 things left to do. One of which is the UK2 preamble.
Yay! We love them.
We love them. I thought Carl did a very good UK. He has not sent me his script to read from, so I'm going to make it up off the top of my head again. UK2.net. They sponsor British Tech Network week after week and month after month and year after year, which is an impressive loyalty. They stump up the bandwidth for the network and they ask very little, apparently, in return, other than that we send people their way to have a look at the web services that they offer. And that's the kind of the way to do it. They're not pushing anything. They're saying, come look at the website, look at what we do, look at the prices, you know, and make your own decision. And to be honest, it must be working for them in a business sense because they're still with us. And looking at the prices and the services and the breadth of stuff they do, you know, hats off to them. UK2.net, you're obviously doing a brilliant job. And the comics people salute you. I've got several domains and websites and stuff going on with UK2.net. And they're always there, always works, always up. What more can you ask for?
You can ask for a discount.
You can. And you know what? If you go from the... oh, thank you, Paul. If you go from the British Tech Network website to UK2.net, there's a whole range of discounts that you can get for domain services, for web hosting, for all that stuff, so you can get money off. Same service, same customer service, same good stuff, but crucially, less money. So that's UK2.net. We can go stop Skyping stuff. My Skype thing is full of like notes about stuff that I'm 10 minutes ahead of. So Kelly, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter and app.net as Verso, and you can also find me over on tuaw.com, the unofficial Apple weblog, and as a host on Angry Mac Bastards.
That's a bit more sweary than this podcast, isn't it?
A lot more sweary than this podcast.
But well worth a listen. I can. It's one of my regular downloads, that one, so I can heartily recommend that one.
Yay.
Jeff, you're everywhere.
I am everywhere. Yes, the internet. It is mine. But mostly Mac Observer. So it'd be macobserver.com. And Apple Context Machine, and We Have Communicators, and The Big Show, and The Comic Show. And Twitter, so that would be jgamut. App.net is jgamut. You're right. I am everywhere. Oh, and freshbrewtales.com.
Yes, that's
where
the
talk about coffee shops.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm
Jeff
everywhere.
Has his own internet.
I do.
One of them is just his.
Do you know when they said Google is responsible for 25% of all web traffic? Mm. Jeff's responsible for the other 75%.
He yes.
is. Yeah.
And you're welcome.
You're not so many places, are you, Paul?
I'm barely anywhere. I'm a ninja. Stealth ginger ninja me. All you can do is, if you have a look at www.kercal.co.uk, that'll take you to the Flickr and the YouTube and all the artworky bits that I try and do when I'm trying to do all the artworky bits.
Excellent. And I'm at Dr. Happy Mac when I'm fixing Macs. I'm sure I mentioned last week that I'd try and do something different for the artwork and things, and I obviously haven't done anything different, so it's all at Dr. Happy Mac. If you go to the G Plus community, you can find me there. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Happy Mac, app.net, I believe it's still going, Dr. Happy Mac, which is good. So, and with that, I think at just over the hour and a half, have we done it?
I think so. Oh.
We didn't even nearly fit everything in, did we?
Part one or two.
Yeah.
We have a full show for next week. We did notes that we didn't go over this week.
Yes, next week we're going to be doing web comics. The Google show notes is already full of all the web comics that we didn't talk about this week, so we'll be talking about those next week. And I invite you to join us because it'll be fun.
Please do.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And good night from all of us.